And the numbers this morning, wind is calm, 34 degrees Racine, 33 Kenosha, 29 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Quick word about the morning show archive. We experienced some difficulty this week, we think due to the daylight savings time change over the weekend. But we are working to rectify the problem. So if you are looking to rehear any morning shows from this coming week, give us a day or two in the morning show archive for this past week. Should be up and running and operating correctly again. And we want to remind you that on Monday's morning show, something very special planned, a rebroadcast of my conversation from 2004 with former Carthage College football coach Tim Rux. We recorded this particular interview just after the Carthage football team had enjoyed the most successful season in the college's history, going all the way to the national championship game in Division III football. A fond remembrance of Coach Rux. Also joining me on Monday live in the studio will be Athletic Director Bob Bahn with a tribute to his colleague and good friend who died last week. Now to today's morning show on WGTD. We're going to be talking sports over the next few minutes and specifically sports broadcasting with someone who has been active in the field of sports broadcasting for many, many years, particularly over the radio. And I'm sure many of you who are sports fans know the name Ann Liguori for all of the various interview programs which she has done over the years to outstanding fashion. And in particular, her program Sports Interview with Ann Liguori, which is about to become available or is now available through Hulu, which allows you to very easily access a rich, deep treasure trove of interviews which she has done with a whole host of sports luminaries over the years. She has had a wide-ranging career, which has included hosting a number of talk programs. She has helped provide coverage for 6 different Olympic Games, and over the years she has spoken with all kinds of incredibly important figures from the world of sports, great, great athletes. And in a really wonderful interview series which she had, she also did a number of interviews with celebrities outside of the world of sports, specifically musicians and actors and so on, while playing golf with them. And so she has wide-ranging talents and skills and experience as an interviewer. And so I'm very excited about this opportunity to connect with Ann Liguori and to talk with her about her exciting career. We welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about the genesis of all this. First of all, is your interest in sports as a broadcaster primarily because you yourself were directly interested in sports, and I think especially the wonderful game of golf?
Yes, well, it all started. I was, you know, a naturally gifted athlete growing up. And I grew up in a small town in Ohio, Brecksville, and had an older brother. And, you know, all the neighborhood kids would come to the yard and play sports. Our backyard was the place where everybody gathered. And I, a lot of times, was the only female and sometimes the first one picked because I was, so fast back then as a runner. And, I always loved sports, Greg. And but even when I was 3 years old and living in Cincinnati at the time, I was born in Cincinnati before moving to Brecksville outside of Cleveland. Can you imagine that I knew what I wanted to do when I was 3 years old? I must have been sitting in a high chair watching this incredible program called Ruth Lyon. She was a true pioneer in the news talk and entertainment talk genre. She had her own show, and now I'm going back to the 60s now. And she was a singer, and she played the piano. But all the most fascinating personalities who came through Cincinnati seemed to find her in her studio, and she would interview them. And I knew way back then she had such an influence on me. It's amazing how influenced you can be as a toddler. But from the very early, days, I remember wanting to be a talk show host. And then because of my sports background and my athletic ability, I just always knew I would pursue sports broadcasting. And it wasn't something, a lot of women were doing back then, but I was very determined to succeed at it. And, it hasn't all been rosy. I mean, there have been challenges along the way, but all these years later, I'm still doing it and still very passionate about sports broadcasting.
Mm. Let's talk for a moment about that matter of being a woman in a field that, particularly when you began, did not have all that many women in it. And the few women that were in it probably were viewed as oddities as much as anything. Although they were certainly there and doing good work. How much trepidation did you feel, how much optimism did you have that there was going to be a meaningful place for you in a universe which, at a glance at least, seemed to be so utterly dominated by men?
I really didn't think about that, Greg. Obviously, the odds were against me because there were so few women, doing it. But, I was an athlete, so the fastest winner won the race, and the best volleyball team won the game. So I was used to, I think the confidence that I gained as an athlete from a very early age truly helped. And then I just stayed really focused and basically had tunnel vision. And I came to New York City right out of college. I went to the University of South Florida. I studied broadcast journalism. Did a lot of different internships in Tampa. And back then, there was a woman anchoring sports at the NBC affiliate. Her name is Gail Sarin. And at least back then, I could see a woman doing it. And she soon after moved into news, and she's been doing news anchoring all these years. I think she's just retiring this year. But, lucky me that I had, at least somebody that I could look to who was actually, doing it in the market. And she made history, she went on to call a game for NBC Sports, and she wanted to stay in the Tampa market, so she didn't pursue, a network sports career. But at least I had somebody to look to. But when I came to New York City and had the opportunity to freelance and got a job at CBS Sports, obviously it was very male-dominated. At the time, Phyllis George, former beauty queen, was hosting the NFL Today show. So at least there was a woman doing that I could look up to. I just basically had various goals, and I left CBS and started a freelance career. And I've been independent ever since, working for a variety of different companies, but always, independently. And I remember the very first couple years at WFAN, the first all-sports radio station in the country. That started back in 1987 here in New York. And I was the first woman hired to host a call-in show, which I did every weekend for over 20 years. But in those early days, there were no women really doing call-in sports talk shows on radio. So, yes, I felt a lot of pressure. I figured if I blew it, not only would it hurt my career, but it would hurt other opportunities for other women. So I put a lot of pressure on myself to not only do a good job, but almost you had to be flawless. You had to know so much about sports, and, you know, it was a call-in show, and New York's such a knowledgeable sports town. So, you know, it was tough in the early days. I really crammed and studied and had to know everything about New York sports. I didn't grow up in New York, so I had some catching up to do.
As a woman, did you feel like you had to do what you were doing in kind of a male sort of way? I mean, did you feel like you were consciously going out of your way to relate to all of the, I would assume, mostly male callers, for instance, or the mostly male athletes that, with whom you were interacting and interviewing, or did you feel fairly comfortable just being yourself and being a woman and doing this as a woman?
No, I was very much myself. I maintained my professionalism and, establishing my credibility was very important. I did, as I said, I did a lot of research, a lot of homework. And I found that the athletes were very impressed, that I, obviously came to the interviews and did my reporting and interviewed them in the locker rooms, very prepared and knowing what I was talking about. So I really didn't have a problem, kind of winning the athletes' trust in me and credibility. It was just tough because there weren't a lot of openings for women at the time. There weren't a lot of job opportunities. It's still very tough for women to break through in this male-dominated business. And I remember going in the early days. When I worked at ABC Radio Sports Network, I covered every team in town, and so my job was to go in and get sound bites from, the players that scored the winning basket or scored the winning goal. And those days were tough because, having to do this in a locker room environment is not easy. And I just remember wearing the most conservative outfits I could wear, just not because I didn't want to call attention to myself. I didn't want these guys talking to me because I'm a woman and, or giving me a hard time. Perhaps because of how I dressed. I just wanted to go in there, be professional, get my interview, and get the heck out of there because that was the only way you could get interviews with these people. They didn't bring them out of the locker room to talk to anybody. So, those days were tough, and I was so delighted when I didn't have to do those locker room interviews anymore and I could, have the guest in my studio or go to a great golf course and spend the day with somebody playing golf and interviewing them.
Right. In those early days, what would you say was the typical attitude of athletes with which you interacted? Or is it impossible to generalize? I mean, for a fair number of them, did they seem demonstrably awkward or maybe even irritated to be talking to, of all things, a woman in a sports interview? Or were a lot of them relatively comfortable with the notion? I mean, again, back in the day when that was really quite uncommon.
No, it was definitely uncommon. There were women before me who, paved the way. I wasn't by any means the first. But, in some cases it was awkward for, depending. But I was, once you get established in the market and they're used to seeing you, game after game, I had a few problems, actually, the very first interview I ever did in a locker room was with the New Jersey Nets, and I'll share the story because it's, kind of embarrassing and a little funny when I look back at it. But Mike Jaminski, who, the center for the Nets, tall as can be, and they are supposed to know when women are coming into the locker room, and you normally don't go in. They get about 10 minutes before anybody goes in, so they can shower and get dressed, and I walked in and they weren't dressed because they weren't really, I guess, expecting me to come in. And so I was interviewing Mike Jaminski. He made one of the winning baskets. And he was so tall, I literally had to say, please put a robe on and please sit down because, it was very embarrassing. So that was my very first experience. So it couldn't have gotten more awkward than that. And then there were, athletes that, were trying to you know, hey, honey, why don't you come out with me tonight? Or let's go to dinner. And, you know, I had a lot of that. And you basically just ignore them. Or, you know, one of the athletes did that. And he was with the, you know, the Mets at the time. And he had his hand in a cast. He wasn't playing, but he was one of the top players for the team. And he was, you know, annoying because he just kept, you know, teasing me and saying things like that. And I just finally said, listen, if you don't stop doing that, I'm going to get my boyfriend to break your other hand. So you have to come up with things that you're going to say. And I said it with a smile on my face because I had to continue to interview him. I couldn't alienate him completely, but I didn't want him to bother me like that anymore. So you find ways to handle those crazy situations.
Mm. By the way, when we talk about back in the day when you first began, it actually probably would be helpful if we had at least kind of a rough idea of when we're talking about. I mean, when did you actually begin your work as a professional sports broadcaster?
Sure. Well, I graduated from University of South Florida in 1982. And as I said, I did a lot of internships in the market and at the school, which taught me a lot. And then I earned a fellowship from the International Radio and TV Society. And they still have this incredible program where they bring, you know, I don't know how many they bring now, but back then it was between 20 and 30 students and graduates to New York to pursue fellowships and to meet with the movers and shakers in the business. And I was honored to have been one of the people selected back in the summer of 82. And I came to New York City and never left. You know, I met a lot of important people in the business and had a lot of informational interviews where I learned about various areas in broadcasting that you don't necessarily learn, you know, by going to class. And I just loved New York City. I always wanted to, you know, pursue a career in the Big Apple, being from a small town in Ohio. And all these years later, I'm still in New York. So it started in 82. My first job was at CBS Sports, again, a freelancing position. And then I kind of left CBS Sports, and when I got opportunities to be a statistician for Wimbledon, for HBO Sports, and the U.S. Open, and I kind of just took a big risk and left a pretty much a full-time paying job to freelance. And it can be very scary because you don't know where your next dollar is coming from or your next assignment is coming from. But I've been independent ever since, and started my own production company and the sports interview show, and, you know, then also was on WFAN radio that whole time. 1987, the first year the WFAN went on the air, and I'm still working with them covering, you know, major golf and tennis championships for WFAN and CBS Sports Radio Network. So it's been a long run, but I continue to enjoy it.
Great. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Anne LaGuari about her long career as a sports broadcaster, and we'll be talking specifically about her series called Sports Interview with Anne LaGuari, which is available now through Hulu, which allows you to access this extraordinarily rich archive of interviews which she has done over the years with all kinds of legends from various sports. Quite apart from the whole issue of being a woman when you be well, you're still a woman, but a woman as you began your career when it was not common for a woman to be in this career. Quite apart from all of those challenges which you've just been describing, is also the fact that when you are engaged in a wide-ranging career like yours, there is also the challenge of dealing with all of these different sports. And of coming to a deep enough understanding of each and every one of them that you can conduct an intelligent, probing interview with various athletes in various sports and be capable of asking questions beyond the banal, what did it feel like to win this trophy or whatever. Just tell us about that process of gaining that kind of impressive grasp and knowledge of a wide range of sports. How difficult Sure. was that, and how did you go about doing that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've been an athlete my whole life, but, you know, that gives me tremendous insight into, because I was so athletic in so many different sports. You know, I played tennis, I ran track, I played basketball, I played volleyball, and I followed you know, football and baseball and a variety of sports when I was a kid. But again, coming to New York, I didn't really know much about the New York sports scene. So, yes, it was like taking a crash course and, you know, just consuming every sports page, reading everything you could get your hands on. Back then, we did not have the internet. So I remember cutting out articles about various sports personalities that I thought I would one day interview. And I kept files on every person that I thought one day I would have the opportunity to interview. Now you just go to the internet, put in somebody's name, and all this wealth of information pops up. But back then it was a lot more, the process was difficult because it took a lot. It was very labor intensive. And but my days at ABC Sports Radio Network, were amazing. I mean, every day, you know, we covered the top sports events and news of the day, and I had the opportunity to actually, as a freelancer over there, produce for Howard Cosell's show. And I got to tell you, you're thrown in the fire pretty quickly when you're that young and producing for, you know, he was just a legend, as you know. And I'll never forget my first day on the job there. He had already done his commentary, which was going to be repeated later in the day. And I listened to it, and he had made a mistake. And I couldn't let this commentary go out again until he corrected one line of this commentary. And so I asked the engineer what his phone number is so we could call him at home. He had already left, the building. And his engineer looked at me like I was crazy. He's like, "You're not going to call Howard and at home. Are you kidding me?" And I was, you know, as far as I knew, I was the producer, and it was my job to make sure it was right because it was going out to all these affiliates across the country. And so I found his number, and I called him. And I said, "Hello," and he happened to be home and picked up the phone. And I said, "Hi, Mr. Cosell. You don't know me. It's, you know, my first day on the job here at ABC Radio Sports, but, you know, you said this in your commentary, and you meant to say that. Do you mind if you just redo one line?" Well, meanwhile, the engineer is as white as a ghost. He's about to pass out. He couldn't believe that I would have the nerve to call him. And and there was this long pause, and all you heard was, "Do you know who I am, young lady? This is Howard Cosell. I don't make mistakes." Well, I thought I was going to die. I thought my career was over. I thought that was the end. And I knew I had to come up with a good line or I was going to be through. And I just said, "Well, Mr. Cosell, you'll be much happier if this is perfect. And I know you don't make too many mistakes, if any, but you did on this commentary. So, you know, I'll play it for you and you can hear what you said and just retract that one line and I'll edit it and it will be great." And, you know, I finally got him to do it. But yeah, he never forgot my name after that, Greg.
I bet. Do you happen to remember?
It's amazing how he just, you know, he'd walk down the halls and people would just shake in their shoes because back then it was, you know, there were really only, you know, three networks and Fox had just become the fourth network. This was regional sports cable networks were just starting to go on the air. And this was in the early days of when, you know, he was such a legend in sports broadcasting. And, you know, I think my athletic ability helped give me confidence. And as I said, it just was such great training for everything that I'm doing now. And it just teaches you self-confidence and it gives you some guts.
I suppose then I think what you're saying is that what was maybe a greater challenge was not so much knowing the ins and outs of a game like basketball that you played or tennis or golf or any of the other many sports that you knew either as a participant or as a fan, but the fact that you began your career in New York City, a big sports town, and were interacting with fans and, of course, athletes too, and trying to get to know sort of the ins and outs and vicissitudes of that particular scene, even more
That's
so
right.
than the specific sports and how they were played.
Well, yes. I mean, you don't get that knowledge overnight. I mean, I studied sports my whole life and was, a lot of women might not necessarily grow up as sports fans or are not athletic, but I was and had, it was my passion my whole life. So, I studied it. I read the sports pages. I knew the stats and and continued to do it. And obviously when I came to New York, I consumed it even more and was very prepared, if not over-prepared, every time I went to work, because it was tough for women. You had to prove that you knew what you were talking about because nobody thought you did.
Hmm.
So you had that double standard where you had to really prove yourself every single day as to why you are there and you deserve to be there. And then also to the people that you worked with and your colleagues. And, you have to establish your credibility. And I think that was probably, that's tough for anybody when they're first starting out, and particularly when you're in the number one market.
We're speaking with sports broadcaster Anne Liguori, and we're going to talk now about one of the central matters in your career, this long-time series called Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, which now is available on Hulu for people who are interested in accessing, I don't even know how many hundreds were of interviews that we're talking about that you have been doing for many, many years now. And most of these interviews, lengthy and probing and very, very well done, I might add.
Thank you.
When did that series begin? And you recall who your very first guest was?
Oh, absolutely. I recall like it was just yesterday. Well, as I said, I was doing WFAN and continued, with FAN, but that started in 1987. In 1989, I put my own TV production company together. And I always had a dream to interview sports legends on television. And Madison Square Garden Network, right here in New York, there's a female executive there who, I got to know, and she was in programming. And she said, Ann, we love your work. We can give you airtime for a weekly show, but we can't pay you for it. And I thought, okay. Well, I think that opportunity is big enough for me to try to, capitalize on it, or somehow I'll figure it out. I didn't have a business degree in college. I'd never done any of this before, so I kind of basically had to learn as I went as far as, selling a show and distribution and acquiring sponsors and doing that whole thing. And I just basically really learned and talked to people who were doing it. So I went and for every one sponsor that I was able to get involved with the show, 20 said absolutely not. And, so knocking down doors on Madison Avenue, trying to get meetings with these advertising executives, most of them looked at me like I had three heads. And you're a woman and you want to host a sports show and you are selling it and want to own it as well. Are you crazy? So it was very tough, and there were a lot of days in my early career here where I thought, I think I better just leave and go back to Cleveland. But, I just kind of persevered, and Volvo became one of my first sponsors, and that's a whole story how I, was able to convince the CEO of Volvo to come in to be the title sponsor of Sports Interview. And then after that, Sharp Electronics came in, and they were my title sponsor for, at least 10 or 11 years, which is such a long run to have any kind of, relationship with a sponsor. So, I just started networking with advertising agencies and with marketing VPs and was able to get enough money to put the show on the air. My first guest in 1989 was none other than Mickey Mantle.
Wow.
And Mickey, of course, I didn't see him play. I'm not that old. But, I interviewed all these legends years after they retired. And they all had incredible perspective and could look back and gave me, such a historical perspective. And, he was just fabulous. He got very sentimental when he talked about Roger Maris and his friendship with Roger. People thought that they disliked each other. Mickey told me when Roger hit his 61st home run, a lot was written that there, was some kind of grudge battle between him and I. And that was the furthest thing from the truth. Mickey told me, they got along great. And he pulled out a ball from a case. We did the interview at Mickey Mantle's restaurant, which is unfortunately no longer in business, but it was in business for many, many years on Central Park South right here in Manhattan. And during the show, he took a ball out of a case right there in what he called the Roger Maris booth, and he showed me this ball, that was signed by Roger to Mick, you're the greatest. love Roger. And Mickey got very sentimental when he began to tear up, and he said it was that ball. He said, it's my favorite treasure. And he said, you know, Roger was like a brother to me. He said when he died, it was like losing a brother.
Wow.
He said on the Yankees, Whitey, Billy, Yogi, Hank Bauer, Roger, we were like a family. Hmm. And, you know, so it was just endearing. I'll never forget that interview. He was such a great storyteller and, you know, just really opened up and shared a lot of different sides of himself to me.
Now, one of the challenges perhaps would have been that you could have chosen to ask Mickey Mantle about some of the darker sides of his personality or some of the poorer choices that he made, or the fact that his consumption of alcohol was really kind of changing the dynamics of his life, or were those not issues that were yet all that well known? I mean, did you face any of those choices at that time when you did this interview about whether or not to ask?
Yeah, the drinking was known to insiders, certainly at that point, not to as much to the public. And in fact, you know, the owner of Mickey Mantle suggested we do the interview before 5 o'clock, before cocktail hour, and I adamantly agreed because, you know, I just had, you know, I knew Mickey, and you know, I knew we needed to sit down with him before, you know, he started drinking anything. So. But I didn't ask him about, you know, drinking at that. I didn't know he was an alcoholic. Years later, it all came out, and you know, unfortunately, you know, he, it took a toll on his liver, and it contributed to his death, really. But I did ask, you know, a lot of these legends the tough questions, you know. Brett Favre, we talked about his addiction to painkillers. You know, he played for so many years without missing a game, yet he played in pain. And, you know, he took painkillers and got addicted to them. And I was in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, golfing with him for this show that I did with him. And that show you can see on Hulu.com as well as the Mickey Mantle Show. And Brett, you know, was really opened up about his addiction to painkillers. So, I mean, it just depended on the interview. Pete Rose, you know, was feisty. I got him right after he was banned from baseball. And he was certainly defiant and angry. And at one point, you know, my questioning got him very angry. And he looked like he was about to jump out of the chair and punch me. So, yeah, I mean, I did approach, I did obviously throw in the controversial questions when I needed to. But with Mantle, we basically talked about his success story and how baseball had changed through the years. You know, he said, I don't blame the players for making $1 or $2 million. One thing I wouldn't do if I was Mr. Steinbrenner, I wouldn't give these guys multiple-year contracts. And he started talking about A-Rod, and he said, I'd never give anyone a 10-year contract. It takes all the incentive out of it. So, you know, with him, it was more about his opinions on the game at that point and how it was different from when he played.
It's very easy to paint with a very broad brush when it comes to the most famous of professional athletes. Often the perception is that they live such privileged lives and so often end up living their lives with a profound sense of entitlement and can be very unapproachable and so on. And of course, if we look a little closer, we find that the array of top flight athletes are just as varied as the rest of us are. And I'm sure you can think of great athletes you've interviewed who line up with that stereotype I just described, and many others who do not, who were perfectly down to earth and open and generous and I imagine after a while, though, that gets to be kind of bewildering to to be confronting such a wide range of human beings. And,
right.
And with each one, it presents its own unique challenge about how to get the most compelling interview from this particular athlete.
Sure. I mean, you know, with this series, Greg, I pretty much, you know, just talked to the personalities that I wanted to talk to, whose stories I wanted to promote, you know, and most of them, you know, were and those who are still around are still positive role models. I mean, there were some that, I interviewed who were in the news at that time who might not be great role models. But for the most part with this series, these are people that I really wanted to talk to. Now in radio, you know, it's more immediate it's basically when I did the show all those years in WFAN, I had guests on that were in the news, whether they were nice people or not. So yes, some of them, were spoiled athletes. But back then they weren't like, the athletes of today. I think today the series would be a lot tougher to do. I never paid any of these personalities to come on my show, and none of them ever asked me for money, to make their appearance. I mean, they might have been promoting a book or a film or something or an event, and that we might have, talked about briefly in the show. But nowadays, it's very hard to get a lot of these top personalities to sit down and to really open up about anything. I think, the definitive interview of Derek Jeter hasn't been done yet, and maybe one day it can be done when he can look back and be a little more open about what his life was really like and how he managed to remain such a hero and have such a great reputation all those years. I think that's remarkable and commendable. Yeah. Tiger Woods, I don't think has ever given the definitive interview, and nor may he ever, because of his problems and with his personal life years ago and all the other things happening with him. So, I think back then these athletes and were just really happy to share their stories, and they, as they say, they were well past, many of them were well past their careers, although people like Dale Earnhardt was still like one of the superstars in NASCAR when I had the opportunity to interview him, and Wayne Gretzky was still playing. So there were people that were still playing, but they were humble and very gracious, and I just enjoyed talking to them.
Hmm. I wonder if you could recall somebody that you felt was, on the one hand, maybe one of the best storytellers that you ever interviewed among these elite athletes. I mean, somebody who just knew how to tell a story versus maybe one of these elite athletes who was exceptionally intelligent and articulate. I mean, in terms of talking about the game in really sophisticated, articulate fashion. Because, of course, just because you're a fabulous baseball player or a fabulous anything in the arena of sports, that doesn't mean you know how to talk about it in compelling fashion. But I know you've talk to some athletes who, in fact, really had some very impressive skill in that regard.
Oh, absolutely. And, as I said, Mickey Mantle was a great storyteller. Ted Williams was just so passionate, an interview, and just such a baseball genius. And I just was so thrilled to have the opportunity to sit down with Ted Williams. His son, John Henry, actually helped me get the interview. And Ted was ailing at the time. He was in his 80s. He came back to Boston for the 1999 All-Star Game, and John Henry said, "Listen, if you come at 11 o'clock, I'll have my dad ready to have your camera crew set up, and he will have just gotten up from his nap. He sleeps a lot, and he'll be sharp and fresh, and I'm sure he'll give you good material." And sure thing, he gave me 40 great minutes. I could have, talked to him all day. I mean, he's just such a baseball genius. And then we talked about, not only his baseball career, but, the fact that he was a co-pilot with John Glenn in the Korean War. And, how wonderful it was to see John Glenn become an astronaut and go into space. He said it was the best day of his life when he was just so excited for John Glenn. And so he just gave me so much great material. And then somebody who surprised me from that standpoint, Greg, was Will Chamberlain. What a compelling interview Will Chamberlain was. If you see the Will Chamberlain show on Hulu.com, I think you'll be pleasantly taken. I mean, I say this because he was on a book tour at the time. And the main promotion from this book tour was the fact that he slept with 20,000 women. I don't know if you remember any of this,
right.
But it was just such an odd thing that he wrote about and said that happened. And, of course, that was getting all the attention. And I certainly thought that was the ugliest part of the book was fascinating. And not just, he just talked about so many different sides of his life. And he was so compelling. When he was a kid, he was 7'2", or however tall he was, at the age of 14. And he said he was considered a freak back then, and it did so much damage to him psychologically. It made him very insecure. He would be on a bus, and he'd want to give up his seat to an elderly person, and he couldn't because he couldn't stand up in the bus. He was too tall. And so it just did so much damage to him mentally when he was a kid. And then he became, this great basketball player, and the height obviously was to his advantage. And he said it helped him get the ladies. And yeah, I just thought he was a compelling interview. So there were a lot of the people that I chose to interview, I did because I knew enough about them that I knew that they would be a good interview.
Hmm. I think because you're speaking to someone in the state of Wisconsin, I would be remiss if I didn't mention how much I enjoyed the installment of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, which featured your conversations with several legends of the Green Bay Packers, Bart Starr and Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers. I confess to being heavily biased as a Packers fan, but nevertheless, really enjoyed, first of all, the questions that you asked and the answers that they gave. Can you just say a word about the enjoyment you had in speaking with these particular gentlemen?
Sure. Well, of course, Bart Starr, what a legend and what a gentleman. I have to revisit that show because, I haven't seen it recently. I just remember he was just such a joy to talk to and, so accomplished. And again, never saw him play, but had read about his incredible career. And then to have Brett Favre on this show, again, I flew to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. It was not an easy place to get to. I remember taking like 4 or 5 different flights to get there, this small town in Mississippi. But I spent the day on the golf course with him. And this was before, he came to New York, and before he left the Packers. And what an interesting personality he was. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about a lot of different things, what his dad meant to him. His dad coached him in high school. And then we brought up the whole subject of how he got addicted to painkillers and had to check himself into rehab and how tough it was to play with pain and get off of the painkillers. So, we touched on some kind of uncomfortable subjects that he was very, very open about. But, both incredible personalities, and I was delighted to have a chance. I did not have a chance to talk to Aaron Rodgers, so unfortunately I'd love to talk to him. But he would be somebody that I'd love to sit down with in the future.
One of the really interesting facets of your career is that in addition to this wonderful series of lengthy sports interviews, again, that are available now through Hulu, you also had for a number of years on one of the golf networks on television, I don't remember which one now, an interview series in which you would interview celebrities of various stripes, as I recall, mostly actors and musicians and so on, but
sure.
and maybe who might have incidentally been athletes of one kind or another, but that's not why they were celebrities. I wonder if, as you reflect on those many interviews which you did and which are also so enjoyable, did that feel like a completely different thing to you? I mean, did they seem like very different interview subjects to you? Did they approach interviews very differently than, for instance, the many athletes that you interviewed? Or is that also maybe something impossible to make generalizations about?
No. A very interesting part of my career, while I was doing the WFAN Sports Call-In Show on the weekends and hosting Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, the Golf Channel was being formed, and the guys who were putting it together were from New York. They used to, the programming executives used to work at HBO Sports, whom I got to know, you know, from my statistician days covering Wimbledon and U.S. Open. And they asked me, hey, you know, we're putting this network together in Orlando. Can you put a show together for us? And this was a very quick phone call. Within 2 minutes, I came up with the show idea. I thought, well, everybody there is going to be talking about, you know, pro golfers. Why don't I do a weekly show where I interview celebrities who have a passion for golf, you know, sports stars and Hollywood stars and music icons and businessmen and women who love golf. And, you know, the show really wasn't about their golf game. It was really more about their success stories and what I learned about them while playing golf with them. So it was called Conversations with Ann Liguori, and it was on for the first 4 years of the Golf Channel. And I remember I had to convince Sylvester Stallone to do this show. He was my very first guest on this series. And the channel wasn't even on the air, and that's a whole other story about how I got him to be my first guest. It gave me gray hairs. I became a blonde after that. But, yeah, it was. I just learned very quickly that interviewing these personalities while golfing with them gave me such incredible insight into their lives. They were much more comfortable. They all loved being on the golf course. It was getting out of a studio, and they were much more relaxed. And I had the whole day with them. You know, by the time I interviewed them and then got footage of them playing golf, you know, you really felt like when you play golf with somebody, I don't know if you're a golfer, Greg, but
I'm not.
You learn so much about a person because you're out there for so long. And you learn if a person, does the person lay up or does he go for the green? You know, that is the person aggressive or is he or she, you know, are they risk takers or do they play conservatively? Do they, how many mulligans do they take or are they really honest or do they cheat? Or, I mean, I had incredible success with these personalities, getting to know them. Evel Knievel, Celine Dion, Matthew McConaughey, Alice Cooper. A few of those are up. The Matthew McConaughey show and the Alice Cooper show are on Hulu.com right now. And I'm hoping to get more of these celebrity shows on because they're just fascinating.
Yeah.
Because again, I use golf as a vehicle to get to know them.
Sure. I'm just fascinated with the notion of Alice Cooper playing golf, actually.
Well, you know, Greg, he told me the day he got out of rehab, he played 36 holes of golf and hasn't stopped.
Huh.
And he transferred his addiction from whatever he was doing to playing golf. And he's a scratch golfer. He plays every day. And I've gotten to know Alice and his lovely wife, Cheryl, through the years and go and play in his celebrity tournament every year in Scottsdale. And he's just such a wonderful person, so unlike his onstage persona. You wouldn't believe it. He's just a pleasure, you know, to golf with. And yeah, he plays golf, and he's very good.
Fascinating. Well, we have covered quite a lot of ground here, but we want to return to kind of our main matter, which is just to remind people that Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is now available through Hulu, and it offers people the opportunity to sample not only the interviews which we've specifically mentioned today, but beyond that to probe into all kinds of other interviews with all kinds of different athletes in a wide array of different sports. In our closing minute or two, I want you to say a word about the Ann Liguori Foundation.
Oh, thanks so much for asking, Greg. Well, I lost my dad to cancer when I was in college, and my 22-year-old brother to leukemia about a year and a half after my dad passed away. And so from a very early age, I started doing a lot of charity work to raise money and awareness for, you know, cancer and other causes. And I did a golf tournament every year in the Hamptons and continue to host it. Now I have my own foundation. It's our 17th year. It's May 18th at the world-renowned Friar's Head. It's just an incredible golf course on the east end of Long Island. And you know, we are able to write checks to a lot of different organizations, the American Cancer Society, St. Jude's. We bring in nutritionists to teach young people about the importance of good nutrition and fitness. And so we've established a scholarship for sports media for women with the New York chapter of Women in Communications. So, you know, I'm just very happy, you know, we've been able to raise a lot of money and awareness for a variety of organizations. And as I say, we're in our 17th year, so our next event's coming up soon.
Fabulous. And more information about what we've been talking about is available at the website, annligori.com. That's annligori.com. Thank you so much. What a great pleasure it's been.